This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
When the history of our time is written 300 years from now, what will be the biggest story in that history? None of us can know for sure or even predict with any great confidence. But I would suggest that the Cold War will be, and its end, will be the third story in that history when it is written 300 years from now, despite all of its significance. I would suspect that the relationship between, if I can call it that, our world and the Islamic world and how it plays out for good or for ill will be the second story in that history book. And the rise of China, India, and Asia will be the largest story in that history book. Think about this. Why did they call it the Industrial Revolution? Why did they call it a revolution? They called it a revolution because if you look at standards of living in ancient Athens and standards of living in Europe in 1750, there is a great debate among historians. Some think living standards were the same in Europe in 1750 as they had been in ancient Athens. Some think that over 2,200 years, living standards had increased by 50 to 75%. Nobody thinks they had changed in a hugely profound way. And all of a sudden, for the first time in human history, with the Industrial Revolution, growth started to take place at a rate where you could see living standards change within a single human lifespan, at a rate where, at the end of a human lifespan, standards of living were perhaps 75% greater than they had been at the beginning of a human lifetime. And that revolution accelerated, and if you look at the most rapid periods of growth in American history, standards of living at the end of a human lifespan were perhaps 4 or 5 or even 6 times greater than they had been at the beginning of a human lifespan. At growth rates that have prevailed in China for a generation now, standards of living increase not by a factor of 1.75, not by a factor of 5, but by a factor of 100 or more within a single human lifespan. Think about the arithmetic. At 7% per year, something doubles in 10 years. A human lifespan is 75 years. That's 7.5 doublings. That's a factor of about 170. Now, growth may slow. Growth may not occur at exactly those rates. But if we are talking only about living standards rising not for one small fraction of humanity, Northern Europe in the 1800s, but for the 40% of humanity that is in China, India, and the other emerging Asian countries, at a rate of growth where living standards increase even 50-fold, we are talking about an event that dwarfs, in the ways in which it changes everything, even the Renaissance and the Industrial Revolution. And so I would suggest that for all of us concerned about our country's future, for all of us concerned about prosperity, these events and how they play out for good or for ill is the central challenge of our times. What can one say? What do we know on the basis of economic study and economic logic about these events? I would highlight five aspects for your consideration. First, the rise of Asia means more human betterment more quickly than anything that has ever happened before. If one looks at the number of people who are relieved from lives of backbreaking, tedious physical labor and provided with opportunity to be connected to the world with all that means, elementary medical care that can reduce pain, the broadening of horizons that literacy represents, the opportunity to see beyond and live a life that is not confined to a small village where one has lived for one's entire life, the opportunity for women to earn a livelihood and not be treated as a commodity, as is the case, as has been historically the case in so many places. These are profound trends which literally can be life transforming for hundreds of millions of people if they are able to continue. They are, and this is the first crucial policy lesson I would suggest, centrally related to the increasing openness and integration of these economies. There is no country that has ever grown on a sustained basis at more than 6% a year, except with an economic strategy that emphasizes international integration and export-led growth. To stand against these countries' growing integration into the global economy is to stand against those opportunities for emancipation for hundreds of millions of people. To stand against their integration into the global economy is to consciously take a step that is denying the opportunity for progress to their citizens with the potential attendant geopolitical consequences. So the first great consequence is profound benefits for very large numbers of people with tremendous gains to be had from allowing the integration that accompanies both transformed policies in these countries and technology. The second large implication of what has taken place is that it has tremendous benefits for the American economy and for the industrialized economies in ways that we are often very slow to appreciate. The third change is in some ways more paradoxical, and I suspect is shorter-lived, and that is the remarkable change in global financial conditions that the integration of emerging markets has meant. Now, anyone who studied economics but did not look at economic data, who had heard what I have said so far and was asked to predict what its implications would be, would have very little difficulty answering the question. They would feel that if there was a slow-growing, aging core of the global economy and a rapidly rising, young, opportunity-laden periphery of the global economy, that there would be a substantial flow of capital from the industrial core to the global periphery. They would be wrong. In round numbers, the developing world exported $1 trillion of capital, or will export $1 trillion of capital to the industrial world this year, with the world's greatest power also serving as the world's greatest borrower and borrowing the vast majority of those funds. How does that happen? Why is that happening? It's not something that I think at the highest level we as economists completely understand. In an arithmetic sense, it goes to the facts that savings rates are extraordinarily high in developing countries, and that they are made to be high by a whole set of policies, particularly in East Asia, that are directed at suppressing consumption and encouraging savings. Those policies are supported by a very conscious financial policy of maintaining exchange rates at levels where international producers are extremely competitive. How do you maintain an exchange rate at a given level when people want to buy your currency and so push its price up? You simply print more of it and buy their currency. And that's why China's reserves are expected to grow by $500 billion this year. That's why the Brazil last Wednesday alone bought $2 billion worth of reserves. That's why India's reserves increased by nearly $30 billion in just the first quarter of this year. High savings flowing into large accumulation of reserves are defining the economic strategy of the East Asian countries. Now, to date, the Asian countries and the oil exporters have largely held these reserves in the form that was traditional and conventional for them to hold them when they were an emergency buffer to deal with potential financial dislocation in safe, highly liquid assets like U.S. Treasury bills. Whether they need to do that anymore is very much open to question, and in a different context, I've argued that they don't. But consider for a moment what the consequence of a huge new pool of savings dedicated to the purchase of debt instruments is likely to be. It is likely to mean a bidding up of the price of debt instruments and a consequent reduction in yields, with no matching change in the pricing of risky assets, equities, and the like. If you perceive such a financial environment, what becomes your strategy? Your strategy is to issue as many as possible of those overpriced debt instruments and use them to purchase as much of those underpriced equity assets as possible. Where is our private equity boom coming from? It's ultimately made in these emerging markets. What's to be done? Given their desires, it's probably primarily a benign phenomenon for us, but to the extent that we want to address it, the right strategies involve increased national saving and the encouragement of these countries doing what is surely in their interest and holding a broader, richer portfolio of assets in these national portfolios that are no longer necessary to serve as emergency financial buffers. Fourth major consequence of this, and the one that I would argue poses the greatest social and political challenge in the United States, is very substantial redistributions of income. You know, there's a paradox in the usual account that's given. If you read the slightly breathless business press on these two, on these matters, there tends to be two propositions that you encounter very quickly. The first is that it's an era, a moment, a time of unprecedentedly ruthless international competition that is pressing workers and firms everywhere, particularly in the United States. The second is that it's in a period of nearly unprecedented corporate profitability, with profits having increased at double-digit rates for 14 quarters now, for the first time in history, and the profit share of GNP at a record high. How is it that unprecedented competition coincides with an unprecedentedly high profit share? I think there's actually a relatively simple way of thinking about it, but it involves thinking about a traditional economics notion in a rather different way. We all of us who teach economics, always teach within the first 2 months the concept of a production function. We say that a firm with so much capital and so much labor can produce thus and such output, and then we talk about how the wage is the marginal product of labor and all that kind of stuff. And while we never say it explicitly, what is always implicit is that you've got a factory and you've got so many machines and you've got so many people, or you've got a farm and you've got so much land and you've got so many people. And it's always assumed implicitly that the capital and the labor are in the same place. But suppose that because of everything that Irwin does and that others in this room do, the technology makes it possible for capital in one place, and capital here can include remarkable human skills as well, to combine with labor in another place to produce output. Then what will the result be? The result will be that this extra billion people who've been added to the global labor force will make capital vastly more productive, that they will have access to more capital than they ever have before. Hence, their incomes will rise at very rapid rates. And who is it who will lose? The people who will lose will be those who had unique access to the capital before, because that's the only place where it was. There's a deeper aspect, which is really just the same thing. Think about a city like Rochester, New York. 20 years ago, Rochester, New York was all about Kodak and Xerox. Kodak and Xerox made it a thriving, happy metropolis in which all kinds of opportunities were provided to everyone. Over time, the interests of Kodak and Rochester, Kodak and Xerox, they faced severe international competition. The identification of their interest with the city of Rochester's interest was greatly reduced, and inevitably, downwards pressure was felt. Increasingly, we're seeing the same thing at the national level. When capital here can combine with labor there, capital here's stake in the success of labor here is inevitably diminished. It's perhaps too strong a phrase, but it captures the direction of what is happening to suggest that leading corporations start to feel like they're as much on Davos's team as they are on America's. And it's not because of anyone's bad motives. It's because of the economic pressures that are created by these forces. What's to be done? Surely our national fiscal policy should not be operating in the direction of reinforcing these trends. They should be operating in the direction of minimizing these trends. It cannot be right that a nation that is blessed with credit card companies that are able to track my spending, and when I spend money in a little village in remote India,
They're able to figure out that I did it and collect from me within a month, all with a receipt, all there. That a country with those kinds of technological capacities fails to collect 15% of the taxes that are owed staggers the imagination. And the 15% of the taxes that are owed are not wages. They are a variety of kinds of capital income on which we, some combination of enforce inadequately, expect inadequate reporting, and simply don't collect the resources that we could and we should. And the third key part of responding to all of this as a country is figuring out how we as a country are going to maintain strong American sources of competitive advantage in a world where there's going to be competition in a much wider range of activities than has traditionally been the case. And surely the key to that is going to involve building strength not in individuals, but in collectives. Why, after all, do people come to a university like San Diego or a university like Harvard or to an area like Silicon Valley or to a biological research area like this one? In part, they come because they're nice places. In part, they come because some nice facilities have been constructed. But the main reason they come is because everyone else is coming, and they want to be with the peers. And that's something that is much more difficult to replicate than any individualistic kind of excellence. How are we, as a matter of national economic strategy, going to have as many of those clustered hotspots as we possibly can? There's a fifth and final aspect of this, and here I must say I have a different view than I would have had 7 or 8 years from now, because I think one has to be impressed by the accumulation of evidence. And that is with respect to the whole question of global climate change. You now have to be the equivalent of a tobacco scientist to think that we can have business as usual in the industrial world. We can have rapid catch-up in the developing world with growth at 10% a year that recapitulates the growth patterns that we saw in the developing world. And anything good can happen to the planet over the next 75 years. It is not plausible that all of those premises can be met. If global warming is the ultimate inconvenient truth, to steal a phrase, the penultimate inconvenient truth is that the vast majority of the action is in what happens in the developing world. Because 75% of the increase in emissions over the next quarter century is going to take place in the developing world. Because their economies are malleable in a way that ours is not. And so if this challenge is going to be met, it is going to be met principally in emerging market countries where there is much more low-hanging fruit than there is in our country. How are we going to engage with them to cause them to bring about these changes? We have not even begun to think seriously about the question. We give speeches that say we hope they'll take on a target. But what plausible democratic leader is going to commit that for all time their country is going to use half as much energy per person as the United States and Europe has, because the United States and Europe have engaged, have got there first, without being shown an adequate and more developed, more satisfactory development strategy? What's our framework for responding to their need to assure rapid prosperity and not to see this as an effort to hold them down behind us. To start to answer that question, we're going to have to do something that we as a country haven't done much of over the last 7 or 8 years, which is listen. Which is listen to how they think this problem ought to be solved. Listen to what strategy they, who have as large or larger stake in its successful success than we do, would propose. But I would suggest this to you, that if you think about the area that I worked in heavily when I was at the Treasury, what you might call official financial intermediation, the kinds of things the IMF does, the kinds of things the World Bank does, the largest part of that, 20 years from now, is not going to involve development assistance to countries that have $1 trillion in reserves and a AAA credit rating. It's going to involve responding to this very real set of opportunities for beneficial exchange in the production and in the use of energy. Energy use, profound changes in the distribution of income and economic security, a very different financial environment, a major boon to our prosperity, and perhaps the greatest thing that's ever happened to humanity. It is an exciting time to be alive. It is an exciting time to think about the U.S. and the global economy. But it is a world that abounds both in risk and in opportunity for private business and also for public policy and our country. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.